Terry Bullingham Reel 2.
It was then that we realised that the majority of the weapon systems we had on the ship were fairly impotent in its widest sense of the word, because they were all radar based, and with the aircraft hiding behind the hills and things, that radar couldn't lock onto them. And really the most useful piece of kit we had on the ship was the 4.5, good old 4.5 gun up forward, the World War II technology. So, you know, where we felt all nice and safe behind our missile systems, we suddenly didn't feel safe. And this was reinforced by four Skyhawk aircraft coming in a bombing run with 1,000-pound bombs on ourselves. They were British bombs. There's nothing like getting your own back. And they dropped a pattern of which only one entered the ship. Entered the ship under the flight deck in our after missile area, the Sea Slug missile space. We felt the impact. The bomb actually didn't explode as advertised, because the Skyhawks were so low at 50 feet that the bombs were only getting a 2-second flight time, and they were actually set for 8 seconds fusing. So very fortunately for us, it didn't explode. But from us, our point of view on the flight deck, we didn't know that it hadn't exploded. We felt the impact, felt the shudder. It's a half-ton lump of metal. It went through the Sea Slug spaces and ended up, of all places, in the after toilet, or the after heads in the naval parlance, and rattled around in there. It hit the deckhead in there, or the ceiling, and produced a molehill in the flight deck above it. And we thought this molehill was blistering paint. We thought we were actually standing on top of a raging inferno. And the standard drill in these cases is to get the fire hoses out and do what's known as boundary cooling. In other words, cool the steel to stop it burning through. We're all concentrating on doing this, getting the fire hoses out and getting spraying. And obviously, what was obviously a coordinated attack, two Mirages. I think they may have been Mirage 5's daggers. Came down the length of ships and was their 40mm cannon, anti-personnel cannon. And they were going so fast, really low, at sort of air display speeds, probably just below the speed of sound. But my eye was taken from the Mirages themselves to what they were producing. And below them, there was a straight line of splashes about every 6 feet in the water, stitching the water. And then it's amazing how time expands, because this is all happening in probably space of 2 seconds. Realize that they're pointing at me, sort of a proverbial finger of fate. So we're starting to go into the fetal position and get myself down as we're all just spreading out. And there's just a sickening impact, rather like when one's in a car crash. You know, it's a serious impact, more than being punched in the face or anything like that. I didn't lose consciousness. The obvious expletive came to one's lips, and was repeated from colleagues either side of me as well, who'd also been hit. But when I went down like a proverbial sack of potatoes. That was the last I saw, ever. I remember seeing the actual two Mirages as they saw alongside us. Down like a sack of potatoes, couldn't see anything, not even a red mist, and obviously my mind became preoccupied with this, as you're lying there stunned. Must have done some sort of mental check, because I felt pain in my legs and arms, but nothing in the torso, and I don't, but the mind was preoccupied with this sight thing. Within a couple of minutes, because there were people who weren't hit on the flight deck who were screaming on the intercom doctor and things like that, a colleague of mine, when they rolled me over, apparently said, "I thought your face had gone." So they thought, your face had gone. But it was actually just blood coming from my eye sockets. I'd had a piece of shrapnel going into my left eye. And the impact, the concussion from a shell hitting the bulkhead next to me, about 2 feet away, had actually ruptured my right eye. But this is all, I mean, didn't know these fine detail at the time. I had been wearing goggles, so I had been wearing the type of goggles that double skin, double glaze goggles, what we used to call double glaze goggles. So goodness knows what would have happened if I hadn't been wearing those. I'd also been wearing, I was wearing an American issue flight deck helmet, which was padded and had fiberglass shells. And once again, colleagues tell me afterwards that that helmet was actually full of shrapnel. I probably would have been dead if I hadn't been wearing it. Boss was on my other side, on the left. He'd been hit in the arm with shrapnel, and the air crewman had been on my right. He'd been hit in the area of the prostate with shrapnel, which isn't a very nice area to be hit with shrapnel at all. And he was announcing this loudly to people that he'd been hit in where he didn't want to be hit. So there was a lot of shouting going on, a lot of adrenaline, a lot of panic. Well, not panic, panic's not the right word, but people are disrupted by the events of this. And on the ship, further down the ship, anybody on the upper deck of the ship, the Sergeant of the Royal Marines, who was standing in the forward gun director position, had picked up shrapnel in his lungs and his kidneys, not his liver. And people below deck, some of this 40mm stuff was going through the ship side, and actually getting people below deck. So there are a lot of people who are, you know, hors de combat, but not seriously injured, but no longer had an active interest in the proceedings. Within 2 minutes, people often ask, within 2 minutes the ship's doctor was with me, so I didn't suffer. And talking to other casualties who came from the shore, you know, paras and marines and things and soldiers, some of them had awful sufferings, but I didn't suffer. I had morphia within about 2 or 3 minutes. The doctor said to me, I've got to get you off here. So I knew I was on a journey. I remember being taken to lie, what the casualty station was, the wardroom, the officer's mess, lying on the wardroom carpet in nothing more than a pair of nicks. The petty officer, medical attendant, who I was friendly with, I mean, we used to drink together and things, I said, Steve, I can't see. He said, you've just got a pair of black eyes, Terry. And I thought, you're a lying bastard, Steve. But that's when he was obviously trying. How do you tell a guy that his eyes have gone? And there's not the time to tell him anyway, really. Myself and a couple of the other more flamboyant casualties were taken off the Antrim onto the Canberra, and the first time a Sea King has ever touched down on a county class. There's never been done, never been even tried. But it's amazing what the real thing will make people try, because the Sea King is a rather large aircraft for a county class. But she came on crossways and got us off, and we're on Canberra. And I remember lying on a stretcher on Canberra for a long time, about 4 or 5 hours, feeling quite helpless, just there in a pair of nicks, blanket just strapped into the stretcher, unable to see, lying with other casualties. And that was quite an experience on Canberra. She was still a valid target. She had soldiers on her. And as the aircraft, as the Argentine Air Force are still paying their attention to the ships, she had soldiers on her. The soldiers would be all on the upper deck and just open up with their rifles, as much lead in the air as possible, try and distract the pilot. Sometimes there would be warning. We'd go through a whole sequence of warnings. There was a rather sort of eerie tannoy system. Air raid roaring yellow, air raid roaring red, and then you'd hear the roar. You may hear some concussion, and you certainly hear all the rifles as the aircraft went overhead. Sometimes it would just be air raid roaring red, and then you'd hear it all. And sometimes it'd be, sorry, there was no time for that one, and one would just come out of the blue. I was still aware of what was going on, and I was concentrating quite hard through the morphia what was going on, but I certainly felt very vulnerable. They decided after a while that the ship's medical team decided that they would carry on with operations regardless. It was obviously no point in waiting for things to quieten down. They weren't going to quieten down. And this part I don't remember. It all becomes a bit blurred, but obviously I went in and had, I think, at least 3 or 4 hours of surgery. Well, the surgeon captain's picking bits of shrapnel out of me. I had shrapnel in the knee joints, so there was an orthopedic input there. There was no ophthalmic surgeon. There was general surgery, but they obviously took the piece of shrapnel out of my eye socket, or what they call the orbit in medical parlance, and patched me up and stitched me up. And I remember sort of being drowsily in and out of after the operation. I remember sort of being sick, as one obviously does with anaesthetic. And I remember the orthopaedic surgeon, two of the orthopaedic surgeons talking. I don't know if they knew I could hear them or not, but they're saying his knees are going to be all right. I managed to get the ball out of his knees, and I remember thinking, well, that's quite comforting. At least I'm going to be able to walk properly. But then I can remember a reporter, a news reporter from, of all papers, The Sun, asking me how I felt. I think I told him in words of one syllable. I remember then waking up in what had been Disco on the camera, which was turned into the ward, quotes. And on my left, they'd obviously tried to group people, because on my left I'd had the periosteal air crewman who'd been hit at the same time as me on the antrim, and he was on my left in the bed next to me. Obviously, it was decided that I had a kindred spirit next to me who was obviously going to keep me informed what was going on. He wasn't feeling very comfortable either, and he wasn't feeling very comfortable. And I remember what I thought was a bit of a ghoulish thing when one of the, I think it was a psychologist, a naval psychologist, asked him how he felt having been hit in the prostate area, and I think he told him words of one syllable as well, and so much so that he kept the psychologist away from me, because I didn't really want to be telling psychologists how I felt. The surgeon captain, who'd obviously been the head of the medical team, came to me, and I thought in a very understanding way, we sort of talked between us, and he was trying to say he was a general surgeon, and obviously feeling a bit sort of ghost and at ease, and between us we sort of thought, well, at best it would be one eye, and at worst it would be none, and we left it at that and didn't talk about it anymore. But he wanted to get me off the Canberra onto the Uganda, where there was an ophthalmic surgeon, and he wanted to do that as quickly as possible. And he was even thinking about this while we were still in San Carlos water and still muck and bullets and everything flying all over the place. Quite an experience in that disco, that ward. I was in there a week. The casualties, I remember across the ward from us, there were two young Argentine soldiers who were quite frightened because they'd been told that we were going to eat them. They were young teenagers and they didn't have any English, and apparently they were just really very frightened, and took quite a lot of counselling by the staff of the Canberra and everything to say that they were in a safe area. And
could you speak to them in Spanish?
I couldn't, obviously, but some of the people I think maybe could. Some of the ship's company of the Canberra. But that was one feature I remember. I obviously didn't see them, but I remember they being a feature of the ward. Because it wasn't just UK casualties, there were Argentine casualties in there as well. We were all filthy. We all had to be cleaned up. The Canberra had been a cruise ship. These were Merchant Navy staff. Various people of the ship's company, the staff, would come as volunteers, wash our hair and talk to us. I mean, I needed feeding. Other people needed feeding. There were people who were still in pain. It was actually quite an experience, because I was actually seeing the best side of human nature. It's almost out of adversity. People all clubbed together. It was quite an experience to be involved in that. I can remember one thing, that once we all sort of started getting over the initial shock and surgery, the projectors came out and to amuse patients, started running through the ship's library of films. And I remember there being a sort of quite an irony, and being irony for myself being in a ward as blind as a bat, which had now been turned into a cinema. I can remember that. Decided time came, during this time Canberra sort of got rid of the troops and got out of the main theatre of operations and transitioned to the west, back to South Georgia, where it was obviously 400 miles east, it was a lot safer. And on the way going back there, it was decided that some of us were to be transferred to Uganda, and I can remember this quite clearly, leaving Canberra once again. Nick's on, blanket over the stretcher, strapped in, this time with notes, I think, medical notes with me as well. My medical notes was obviously acquiring a bit of a wad. And being flown, not in, but strapped outside a wasp, flown from the Canberra, strapped outside a Wasp, out in the open air, to a survey ship called the Hydra. And I can remember hanging on the side of this Wasp, somewhere over the South Atlantic, and I'm listening to the Wasps, the engine. I thought, if that engine packs up, I've got a problem. Can't see, nearly naked, what am I going to do if we go and end up in the South Atlantic? Fortunately, we made the Hydra, got on the Hydra, little survey ship, and ended up in what was a makeshift ward there. Colleague on there, ex-colleague, guy I knew well, on part of the Hydra ship's company, part of their flight, knew well. I was asking him if he knew what was the matter with my eyes. I was still preoccupied with my eyes all the time, strange. And he found it difficult to tell me the truth, which I really was getting to know. Now, I hadn't seen light for 8 days. And despite of all, my eyes had dressings on, but even when the dressings came off, there was no reaction, nothing, just black. And he was saying, well, maybe you'll have a bit. The doctor says, maybe you'll have a bit, maybe you're not. And I started to, well, it was, you know, you'll have a bit. What's a bit? And I was starting to think, well, I don't want a bit. I either want the whole thing or nothing. And so the mind was starting to adjust, started to sort of work things out. And also I could tell by the amount of, because I was in company of other casualties, but I was sort of becoming a bit of a celebrity. And I was obviously, and people would come and spend time talking to me and things like that. So I could tell that I was obviously had injuries more than it warranted special attention. And obviously it was arousing sort of emotive feelings in people. They would come and talk to you and make sure you had a good supply of cassettes and things like that to listen to. Another feature I pass it on for what it's worth, probably because of the result of the shock, the trauma, and disrupted eating and the anaesthetics, I hadn't been to the toilet for 8 days, and this was starting to also occupy my thoughts, so much so that one night it sort of took equal prominence as my sight, and I was a bit sort of restricted, because I had a plaster cast on my right arm, and on my right leg I had a total all-encasing bandage, because I'd been doing skin grafting on my knees, so my right leg was sort of locked in a plaster of Paris bandage. So I had a left arm that worked, the left leg that worked, but I couldn't see, so I needed help. And what was I going to do when I got to the toilet? You know, so the typical sailors, there's sort of nothing but practical. They rigged up a system of boxes so I could sit on the toilet with my leg out straight and the leg propped up on the boxes. But despite of sort of all sorts of efforts and everything, nothing happened, but it was still this constipation. But it didn't, it suppressed this, and I was only on the Hydra for a day. And then transitioned from there to the Uganda. And in the Uganda, we were in, I suppose, it was under the quarter deck. And I forget the actual name of the merchant, you know, because the Canberra had also been a cruise ship. It had a name, this thing, but it was under the quarter deck, in the sort of deck below the in the stern area. It was a ward. Welcomed on board the Uganda once again, I think it was another Wasp, yes it was another Wasp, onto the Uganda, welcomed by the Padre, welcomed by nurses this time again, back to nurses, and obviously quite a well prepared medical team. They'd obviously had time to get the ship ready for us, where the Canberra had been more or less caught more on the hop by casualties. The nurses, the nursing sisters, all prepared. And very quickly, the surgeon captain, the ophthalmologist, approached me and said he was going to operate on me. And lost interest in proceedings. I was sort of under anaesthetic, pre-meds, down. And I came to being told that I mustn't move my head for 24 hours. Great. And obviously feeling irritations, to put it mildly, in the area of the eyes. So, lying there 24 hours, feeling pretty wretched, discomfort in the eyes, holding head steady, right leg sore because it's in an all-encasing bandage, left leg sore because that's got a bandage around the knee and I couldn't sort of ease the, I was getting sort of pain, sort of it's discomfort in the area of the heel where it's getting sore and things like that, very difficult, didn't have free movement. And then you know, reminded me, you know, it sort of reminded you how much we do move around in bed when we sleep and things to stop this sort of thing. But I was becoming, feeling pretty wretched, and I think I kept myself going just popping fruit gums in my mouth. Don't even think I had a radio at that time or anything. Just, and thinking. Then I came to, back in the ward, and they, once again, they picked a technician, a Royal Marine technician, radio technician, a guy in his 30s, the same as I was, a colour sergeant, who'd been hit, had almost had most of, I think he had a large part of his leg severed with a bomb on one of the logistics ships, so he was quite seriously injured. But he was obviously keeping me going, and he became my sort of eyes and kept me right for the next week, and looked out all my needs, lit my cigarettes for me and things like that. And came to, the surgeon captain came to me, and he said, still talking about the bandages, and he said, I must get you back to Moorfields, get you back to the UK. And I thought I'd prefer to be back in the UK than on this hospital ship. He mentioned the word like enucleated, but I, of course, didn't know at the time that meant remove one of your eyes. He'd actually removed one eye, and he wanted to get me back to see what was left of the other eye. But he didn't have the ophthalmoscope down on the Uganda, which you look through to a retina. They only had that in the UK. But every day he would come and remove these dressings personally. I mean, obviously, if you're, you wouldn't allow the nurses to do this. You'd remove the dresses personally. I mean, so if you're getting a surgeon captain doing that, there's something at stake. And every time the dressings came off, there was no light or anything, and he'd shine torches in, no reaction. So, I mean, common sense was starting to tell me that it was a bit of a lost cause. And we're now 2 weeks on. But my attention also diverted, because in my other injuries around the legs and arms, there's skins, they're swabbing out all the muck every day, and skin's starting to regenerate. I had to go in back into the operating theatre to have some shrapnel removed from my right knee, and they want to do some more plastic surgery there to patch up the scar tissue. And then I was feeling a bit more human, and I was able to observe. I obviously didn't see what's going on, but the surgeon commanders and things, they were actually really relishing the chance to practice their trade that they've been trained for. And there was a large amount of repartee going on between themselves and between the operating theatre staff. The point about the operating theatre, we were actually taken in and out of these areas and handled as patients by members of the Royal Marine Band. This was one of their traditional roles, and they would handle us, move us around to and from the wards, because I mean this isn't a hospital, this is a cruise liner that is doing a job as a hospital ship, and so moving people around was quite difficult. There was that experience there. There was they scanned my frontal lobes of my brain very minutely, because they were making sure I hadn't got any brain damage. They said afterwards that they had to make sure of that, because of this shrapnel had gone very close, but it hadn't got through. Several feelings from the ward. Well, I did get my eventual trip to the toilet. I surrendered all sort of anything of dignity. I tried it on a little stainless steel thing sitting on the bed, like the Mekong. That didn't work. I then, two quite understanding nurses took me to the toilet, and I mean, it takes a bit of surrendering your dignity, I mean, to female nurses. Took to me to the toilet. I still had to have the leg propped up and everything, and they left me in peace and quiet, although one was obviously still outside the door. And after about 10 minutes and a lot of sort of biting of the lip, I produced the desired result. It was obviously, I think it was a combination of the stress, the drugs, penicillin and things like that, and the anaesthetic, but I eventually, unfortunately, bowel started them. Once released, they started to work as advertised again. There were quite a the ward, it was full. It was a good atmosphere, again a good atmosphere, and I think it was the ship's mate who elected and volunteered, that he always used to come and feed me, and obviously come and feed me, because I couldn't feed myself in those days. He used to come and feed me. Of course, he was in a privileged position of knowing a lot of what was going on. He used to give me odd little snippets of the rumours and things. I used to find quite entertaining for what was going on the ship. It was quite good. That was all quite good. People recovering surprisingly quickly. It was surprised everybody, even the medical staff, how quickly people were recovering from surgery and things. There was a bad patch when we started to take casualties from Goose Green, and instead of casualties coming by the Wasp load or Seeking load, they started to come by the Chinook load. And there was one incident I remember where it was an RAF Chinook brought a whole load of casualties over, landed on the quarterdeck, and then rolled forward about 15 feet and only just stopped before it hit the superstructure. And we're lying right underneath this. You could hear the thing rumbling around above our heads. That was a panic. Nursing staff and everything, when that, there were several of those Chinooks, they started to get tired. And you could feel, you could tell the girls were getting tired, just literally out on their feet, starting to work double shifts and everything to deal with these extra casualties. We're then getting more and more gory stories as the soldiers are coming down and relating their experiences ashore. We're getting people with, I suppose, what's psychological damage from their experiences, you know, being involved in hand-to-hand and actually shooting people and seeing them drop, which doesn't very often happen in the naval side of things, but of course the soldiers are a lot more, war is a lot more personal. One funny incident, I must relate it to bring a bit of levity to the proceedings, was there was a Glaswegian, I think he was a para, who'd had his arm amputated by surgery. They'd taken his arm off. And he was coming round after the anaesthetic, and I always remember him, he was sort of the typical Billy Connolly sort of voice and everything. And at the time, the matron, I mean, the naval matron, sort of quite a, you know, a revered figure, is doing her rounds, and he's coming round and sort of muttering, ah, and he'd realised that there were Argentine people in the ward as well. And he sort of coming round and saying, what are all these effing Arges doing in the ward? They should be down checking the propeller and things like that. And this sort of caught the matron's attention, and see, being sort of Florence Nightingale type, she trotting across there with her entourage. And as quick as a sort of striking cobra, the good arm, he obviously saw the naval nurse's uniform, the good arm snaked out round her, and he had her sort of pinioned across the bed before she could be sort of rescued by her colleagues. And then I think he was sort of...
pinioned in an amorous way.
Well, in a sort of amorous way, yes. And then I think he was... sedated again to come round properly. That was one funny thing that did just amuse us all. There were funnies. It wasn't all, you know, doom and gloom.
How did she take that?
Well, I think she shook it off. I mean, I think the whole thing of the... I mean, obviously didn't see everything that went on, but it was certainly a ruckus that went on. It was a minor skirmish in the corner of the ward. I think she just dusted herself down, and she would have been in her sort of... early 50s, I imagine, at the top of her profession. The last thing you expect to be sort of assaulted in an amorous fashion by a para, and certainly a Glaswegian. But it was funny, and he used to come up with these dry comments now and again. But the one about the artist checking the propeller was quite clever. I mean...